Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail bro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, nbpp.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's Spirit of Justice conversation between Michelle Alexander and Michael Bennett. I'm Serene Jones. I'm the president here at Union. And this is my good friend, the very Reverend Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas, who is the Dean of the Episcopal Divinity School at Union Theological Seminary. This is, believe it or not, the second year of our Spirit of Justice conversations, where we hear leading activists on a variety of topics, from racial inequality to climate justice to mass incarceration and mass deportation. Our previous guests have included Angela Davis, Patrice Cullors, Naomi Klein, This past fall, Jose Antonio Vargas, and tonight, Michael Bennett.
And so he joins a great lineup. And I thank you, Serene, and good evening as well to all of you. I am pleased to be here and am, like you, looking forward to tonight's conversation. As Serene said, it's not unusual for us to have activists and organizers here at Union. It's what we do as we develop social justice and faith leaders. But it's not every day that we have an NFL player who embodies those roles. Michael Bennett, a Super Bowl champion and Pro Bowler, who is now a member of the New England Patriots. He is a true activist athlete. Off on the field, he runs the Bennett Foundation with his wife Pele to educate underserved children and communities to lead healthier lives through nutrition programs, inner city gardens, and cooking demonstrations, as well as free health clinics. As the father of daughters, Michael is also committed to STEAM education for girls. After learning of his Sinhalese ancestry, he traveled to the country and partnered with the IM Code organization, where he sponsored 100 African girls. Last year, he published his first book, of which I'm sure many of you are familiar, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. The book is part memoir and part manifesto about the turbulent times we are now in.
So this evening is sure to be quite a conversation, because in his book, Michael speaks courageously and openly about race, white supremacy, and racism in America, and how it plays out across society, from police brutality to food insecurity to the powerlessness of athletes within the NFL and the NCAA. Our colleague, Michelle Alexander, will certainly have a lot to discuss, including, as we now know, the family of ministers that he comes from. Michelle is a visiting professor here at Union. She is an acclaimed civil rights lawyer and advocate, author of the best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. She's also a columnist for the New York Times and a dear friend to many in this room.
Now, before we bring them to the stage, we'd like to let you know that following their conversation, you all will have a chance to ask questions. When you arrived, you should have found an index card in your seat. If you have a question for Michael Bennett, please write it on the card along with your name. The cards will be collected, and if your question is selected, your name will be called, and we'll invite you to the microphone so that you may ask your question. We'll try our best to get as many questions in as possible.
And for those of you who are live streaming from home, we invite you to join the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag #SpiritOfJustice. So now, let's get to the conversation. Please welcome Michelle Alexander and Michael Bennett. Good evening, everyone. I'm thrilled to see you all here, and even more thrilled to be here with Michael. I've been excited to meet him since this event was announced. I have to confess that I didn't know who Michael Bennett was until he took his courageous stand in the anthem protest. I am not much of a football fan myself. I used to be when I was younger. I would watch football with my dad in high school and in college. But after my dad died about 25 years ago, I kind of gave up on football and stopped following football. And yet when I saw Michael Bennett taking his courageous stand in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick and began investigating who this
man was and how is he showing up in this world in this way, I became more and more excited about the contributions he was making and the influence he was having. And so when my friend and colleague suggested that we invite him here, Robin, thank you for the suggestion, I was overjoyed at the possibility that you might actually be willing to come. And so thank you so much for being here. And, you know, my son, who is a huge fan and has been following you on and off the field for some time, told me that if I didn't get a picture with you, he was never speaking to me again. So thank you so much for being here. There are many things that I love about this book, things that make white people uncomfortable. But one of the things that I appreciate the most is that you speak in your own voice, real talk about pressing racial and social justice issues of our time and how they've impacted you personally, but also how you've seen them impact people in communities from coast to coast in the United States and around the world. But you speak not as an expert, not as a scholar, but as someone who has cared deeply enough to educate yourself and to become engaged in courageous forms of activism. And I highly encourage all of you to read it. It's the first book on racial and social justice my son has been eager to read. The book has a lot of cursing in it, which only increased his enthusiasm for the material. But the book is not offensive in any way, and anyone who finds themselves offended by the book really needs to check themselves. This is an example of someone bringing their whole self to the page and speaking their whole truth. So I want to get to the book and ask you why you decided to write it. What motivated you to write it? I was particularly struck by a passage in the book where you said, "Your greatest fear of all your fears is not being heard." And it seems that this book was an attempt to be heard. So why did you write the book?
Oh, it was working. The mic was working at first. Good job, Mike guy. Now, for me, writing the book was, I feel like it was my chance to, like, you know how you speak, but the words in the books can never go away, you know, the context of the book. And I wanted to be, oh, okay. All right. She wants me to be louder.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be able to, you know, have something and be able to have my kids look at it and share it, but also, you know, give something to young athletes. I felt like there had been a drought where athletes had been really vulnerable about issues that were happening around them, and showing young athletes what they can do with their platform and not be scared to, you know, speak about things that were happening in their communities and things that happened around the world. So that's the real reason I wrote the book, was for the young kids. The young kids, I felt like, you know, after, you know, the 60s, after Jim Brown and then Craig Hodges later on, there had been a drought for athletes to really have that platform to speak on things. You know, Michael Jordan, you know, he sold a lot of shoes, but he wasn't the one who brought the communities together. If you looked in Chicago, there was a lot of people killing over Jordan shoes. And then there was Kobe Bryant. And then there was, like, there was nothing. There was this silence. And a lot of us young athletes didn't have anybody to look up to as far when it came to sharing, you know, our story or finding ways to have a platform. And then, you know, came LeBron James and came Chris Paul and all these other guys, Carmelo Anthony, and then it came Kaepernick, and then it came me, and then it was all these other guys. And I wanted to be able to have something that, some kind of substance that young kids can follow, and, you know, like, it's not, they're not alone. There's other people who have these ideas, there's other people who have thoughts, and other people who are, that they can connect with. And that's the real reason I wrote the book, was for the young people.
So the title, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable,
yeah,
what
yeah.
are the things that you most wanted people to hear, to understand?
You know, it's funny. Every time the title, when I first said it to the publisher, I was like, First I wanted to do a book about things that make white people uncomfortable at dinner, and it was like a 12-course meal. And every course was an issue that was happening in society, and I wanted to, you know, do it. You know, it was, two reservations. So it was about Native Americans and the reservation. So it was just about this idea of being able to, you know, have a book about making people uncomfortable. Then I was like, no, forget the dinner part. It's going to get too, because then some people don't eat dessert. Some people don't have wine. So I just decided to do the book, just things that make white people uncomfortable. But really it was about, you know, I felt that society has started to become comfortable with things that were happening around us. It was just like every time we see something, we start to become so numb to it because it was just how society was happening. Like we got so used to seeing, you know, police brutality. We got so used to seeing gun violence at school. We got so used to, you know, racism. We got so used to homophobia. We got so used to all these different things, and we became so comfortable with things. And I was like, how can I break that barrier down? And I was thought, to really have some type of growth, you have to be uncomfortable. And I wanted to make a title that was, you know, catchy, but also made people think, like, what can we do to become uncomfortable with society? And how can we make a change with our platform and with our voices? And I feel like that title was kind of raunchy, but at the same time, I thought it was like a cool title because I grew up with, you know, looking up to Dick Gregory, and I thought he wrote the book. And he wrote a book that said the N-word, and it was just like, it was just over the top. You know, watching Richard Pryor and you know, all these other great artists when they came to doing things, and they had that type of way of being able to bring humor to reality, and I wanted to do that with my book.
Mm-hmm. So you talk in the book about your own experience with police violence, and many people associate the anthem protests with police violence and view the protest as exclusively about police violence or primarily about police violence. And you write that for you, kneeling in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick and the protest anthem was about much more than police violence. I wonder if you would begin just by sharing your own story of what happened in Vegas and
I think even before Vegas or things that happened in Vegas, I came to my coach and I was like, you know, my coach, Coach Carroll, and, you know, I had took a knee and I sat down. I had been doing something. Then he came. We had a conversation and he was like, Michael, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Why do you want to say something? We here to play football. We're doing these different things. I just want to know why you want to take this stance. And then I told him, I said, Coach, you know, when I'm in this building, I feel comfortable. I feel like I can be myself. I can be Michael Bennett. But when I'm out there, I'm another black man. Like, the things that are happening to other people can happen to me. And when I was telling him that, he got choked up a little bit because he was like, it was me bringing the reality to that, like, we're different. Like, as much as you think that we are the same as when it comes to coach to player, but when it comes to race relations outside of this building, we're different. Things that would happen to me won't happen to you because of the color of your skin. So I had to break down, you know, that with my coach and explain to him that I had took this spiritual journey. I had spent a lot of time with a lot of different people around the world. I had been to Guam. I had been to Haiti. I had been to Native American Reservation. I had been to Africa. I had been to a lot of different places with people and spent time with people because I felt like that was the true way to really understand other people's story, was not to really speak about it, but to experience through their voice, to experience it through their tears, experience through their emotions. And for me, that was how I came to the point where I felt overwhelmed, and I felt like I had been with all these people, and they couldn't be heard. The people in Native American Reservation, they can't be heard. You know, the woman who lost her son to police brutality can't be heard. The mother who lost her son to police brutality, they can't be heard. But I could be heard because I have a voice, I have a platform. So I felt like I had to do that, and it was beyond just police brutality. It was what was happening in Flint. It was what was happening with the Me Too movement. It was just what was happening with people, and I felt like there was a connection between me and humanity, and I didn't want to lose my humanity because I was an athlete, and I felt because you know, we are athletes sometimes. People build those barriers between us and society, like your society. Like, as you, when you're an athlete, you go through this different world than everybody else. Everything is kind of maneuvered for you to have success, whether it's with school, whether it's with, you know, picking a college. Everything is kind of, there's a template to it. It is a you get this score, you get to go here, you get this touchdown, you get this, you get this sack, you get this incentive. But then there wasn't an incentive to, you know, what would happen to you if you didn't have those things. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, when I had that connection to have that platform, that I stepped out and I was able to have the courage to, you know, share and give other kids that thing, because I felt that, you know, when not having that platform and not having those older athletes to look up to, I felt like now that I'm in that stage, I don't want it to be another drought. I don't want another kid to look back and be like, there was nobody for us to look up to. I don't want nobody else to look up and be like, I'm scared to speak up because nobody's there for me. Nobody has that. I wanted to be, one of the guys, a part of a movement of young people who were a part of that change for our society and what we see good fit for the kids that look like us in different communities, because our voice is so big. It's like when you are an athlete and you go into these communities, it's so much different when you are like, when they bring a certain society to the practice. They might bring a whole bunch of, you know, some different kids. But when you in the hood or you in these juvenile detention center and the kids see you, it's a whole different type of experience, because they don't see a player, they see hope. They see something that resonates with them, their journey, and they want to live vicariously through us. And when we have that opportunity, it's not on us to just to show them like, oh, who we would, oh, here's this woman or this car. It's about showing them how to be a man, how to be somebody in society that can contribute at a high level.
Yeah, I think it's...
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's important that you began your spiritual journey and took your stand before you were attacked personally by the police. And can you say a few words about that spiritual journey? I was moved by what you wrote about your quest to determine whether your faith, whether your Christianity was simply kind of an inheritance of slave owners, or whether it was real and true for you, and that you began reading about other faiths, other world religions, and you began a process of uncovering discovery for yourself.
I think when I started to do that, I felt like I needed to like dig deep into religion to understand my own foundation, to make sure that what I believe in is what I believe in. It wasn't because I was a slave or it was dead. It was because my grandma, because everybody in my family is preachers. Everybody I grew up with is a preacher. We got our own churches. We got our own ministry. We got our own congregation. Everybody, if you go to Louisiana, you know the business is being the preachers. Everybody has a church in my family. So I grew up in the church. And so for me, it was to make sure that what I was learning as a kid, it can still connect to me when I was an adult. So I wanted to, you know, learn about, you know, my wife's family was Mormon, so I started reading about Mormon religion. And in college, I idolized Malcolm X as a kid. So, you know, I grew up reading Malcolm X. That was one of the books that I read as a young kid. And then when I got to college, I was like, let me study what he was studying just to see his journey. And then so for me, religion was another journey to having that understanding of other people. I think I needed to break down the barrier of not understanding somebody to be able to understand them. You know what I mean? Like, not to have this perception that when I see somebody, I build this wall up against them. And how do I build that bridge to other people when, just because they look different from me, they have a different religion, they have a different gender choice, they have all these different things, how can I be the person that I want to be without having all these perceived patience about somebody because of their characteristics or what they believe in? So I feel like religion was the first step to that. Religion, and I feel like religion had been used for a long period of time for war and all these different things. And being the part of, you know, I had got tested a whole bunch of times, and, you know, having to fall back on my religion, you know, whenever I felt like, you know, when I went through my own situations with, you know, with the police or with, you know, the court system, I went back home. I was like, Grandpa, you know, we call everybody in Louisiana. I was like, I need that oil. And my grandpa always put oil out, and then he blessed me, like, you know. And so for me, that's a true foundation of me. So I felt like I needed to go through those religions and understand them to have a better understanding for people, and long story short.
So how would you describe your kind of own personal spiritual journey, the relationship of that to your activism and your commitment to social justice?
I think for me, like, I think activism and religion are connected. I mean, if you look at Jesus Christ and what he did, what he was doing, there's a reason why he was politically assassinated, because he was changing society, because the way that everybody was living, that wasn't the way no more. He was willing to put himself on the cross. He was willing to sacrifice himself for something bigger than just himself. And I think, you know, when you think about that and weigh that on yours, you got to think that spirituality has a lot to do with that. You got to think that spirituality and, you know, people, you know, because Jesus was the type of person in religion and Buddha, whoever it was, when the religion and Muhammad, they went to the lowest places on the earth, brought the people who couldn't have the voice, people who were prostitutes, people who didn't have those things, and brought them to the light. And I think that's important when you talk about activism, because you got to be able to go to those dark places and bring light to them. And I think that's one of the things that I felt like my spirituality and religion had the connection with.
Well, in your book, you weave in a lot of data and some history, and you share data on police violence. Black Americans are 2.5 times as likely as white Americans to be shot and killed by police officers. We are twice as likely to be unarmed when shot, and 3 times more likely to be abused while in police custody. Juries give black defendants sentences that are 20% longer than those given to white defendants convicted of the same crimes. We are in prison 3 times longer for the same drug crimes, even though we use drugs, weed included, less than white folks do. And when we get out of jail, a chance for decent employment, or in some states even the right to vote, doesn't exist. So you had an experience of this coming home to you firsthand. You were in Vegas. Can you share a little bit about what it felt like to go from knowing about this in the abstract and reading about it to actually experiencing it yourself?
I also feel like some things are divine. And I think, you know, whenever I pray, I always say, you know, God, thank you for the trials and tribulations, because I think those trials and tribulations are what makes you a stronger person and gives you the voice to be able to say it, because you experience it. And I think for me, going through that, you know, you have this certain amount of trauma, because you want to, you sitting there and you thinking like, my life could be over, or this could be happening, or this thing could happen to you, and you just sitting there wondering like, damn, like everybody I ever met with, like this is what they felt like, or this situation, and it's a tad bit overwhelming when you're in it, because when you're a parent, you know, you officially give your life up for your kids. Like, so for me, in that moment, I felt like I'm not ready to, I have to be there for my kids, like, you know, think about my daughters and stuff, and so it was a bit overwhelming, because I had spent so much time with kids in prison. Like, that's what I was doing every Friday. I would just be going to this prison detention centers, just spending time with kids every day, because I felt like it was, you know, I was learning, you know, I mean, when I read your book, it kind of encouraged me to make sure that when I'm speaking, I have the information to back that, because I didn't want somebody to be like, oh, this is just his opinion. I wanted it to be fact, you know, have my story on it, but also my way of sharing the facts and be able to articulate that in a way where people can't really, you know, fight it, because it's the truth, it's the information. And I wanted to make sure that in that book that I wanted to show that police brutality isn't a black issue. It's a humanity issue. It's people in general who, you know, go through it. I think on TV they show more black people who go through it, which we do deal with all that, but I wanted to connect the humanity to what people are missing, because I've always felt that whenever there's something that happens in life, people choose sides. And I wanted to be like, it's not about choosing sides, it's about the connection to human life. You know, the loss of a human life. What does that really mean to a family when you're talking to a mother who lost a son, and the son had a daughter, and the daughter doesn't have a father? That's a lot of trauma to one family. So for me, I wanted to connect that in a book and be able to share that with people, and share that, like, you know, you have to be in those rooms with people to really feel their emotions and feel what it feels like for them, and not, you know, try to weigh your conversation. But now I have my own story that I went through, had to face, and I faced it, and the worst part about it, I had to face it in front of the world, because I was dealing, people already hated that we took a knee. They hated that we were standing against something that they didn't agree with. They hated that we were black men, and they felt that we were one of the ones who made it, and that we needed to shut up, because we are the one, we are the anomaly, we are the rare, we are the people who didn't, who made it. And I felt like, because people felt like that. They didn't want to hear us talk about those issues, and I felt like, you know, because of that, you know, that came with a lot of criticism on all different fronts. So, you know.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the fear and the courage that's required to stand up to the President of the United States and to a lot of other people who are very critical of you. There's a theme that runs through the entire book about the necessity of breaking silences and digging deep to find that moral courage, and it's difficult to overstate the pressure you faced, you know, following your decision to take a knee. I mean, Donald Trump was cursing your name. You had fans cursing at you. You had pressure from family members. You had threats of violence against you and your family, and you talk in the book about the need for us to talk more openly and honestly about how fear operates and keeps us from speaking our truth and acting on principle.
I was lucky because I've been able to talk to some of the greatest people who have had some of the biggest fears on the biggest stages of the world, and they were able to overcome them. So one of the people that I felt like I should talk to was Angela Davis, and, you know, and when I talked to her, I'm like, you've been through all this stuff, and how do you keep going? How do you keep the strength to always constantly be moving, having the momentum when fear is being a part of your whole life? You know, you've been on the FBI warning list, people have been looking for you, you've been every single thing, like, and she just, like, said, you know, like, you keep living for the people who don't have a voice. And for me, that was like, it was like this next step. And then I talked to John Carlos, and I'm just like, how do you keep doing it? And then they kind of say the same thing. And for me, having those people and talking to them about the fear of all these things, you see the fear. I mean, fear is a part of it. I think fear keeps us alive when it comes to, you know, being able to have connections. But I also think sometimes fear keeps you from overcoming those hurdles of what could happen to you if you lose your voice. But what are we fearful of? Are we fearful of not having the change that we want to see? We're fearful from losing some sponsor money, but I fear mostly of losing my dignity and my integrity, and I think that's the biggest issue of it all.
Yeah. I was struck by the fact that you said facing your fears made you feel as though you were coming alive, finally coming alive. You were describing, you know, the real terror of having threats against your family, against your daughters, and you wrote, in a strange way, it makes me feel more alive. What does that mean to you?
I was saying that it makes me love the moment more. It makes me, you know, when I kiss my wife, it makes me feel that moment more. When I hug my daughter, it makes me love that moment more, because I knew that there's people who don't get those moments again. And I didn't want to be a person who didn't cherish the moments when they came to me. So when I'm with people, I'm with them. I'm with them. I show them that I care about them. I show them that I have love for them, because if you're in my circle, that's how I feel. And I felt that, you know, that fear of, you know, of not existing, it makes you want to exist more. And I think that was important for me to keep going with family and showing my kids that, you know, that they shouldn't fear. They shouldn't fear. They should be the women that they're supposed to be. They should be the leaders that they want to be. They should be the wives that they want to be, the businesswomen that they want to be, the activists, whatever they want to be. Don't fear, because they look at their father, they look at their mother, and they fear all these different things. How are they supposed to have the voice that they're supposed to have if they can't even look at their own parents? And I'm telling them to be a certain way, but I didn't have the courage to be that way. And I think that's the biggest reason why you take the steps in life and the risks that you take, because you want to be able to leave that legacy with for your kids.
And you inspire a lot of people to overcome their own fear. Some didn't, you know, and you talk about the fact that there were top 10 players, some of the biggest stars in the league, people who were on the way to the Hall of Fame who would come to you and say, you know, wow, I can't believe what you're doing. I could never do that. You know, on our team we could never get away with that. And, you know, you write about the fact that people have a way of underestimating their power and their influence, and that many folks were more interested in protecting their brand than anything else. But can you say more about the necessity of organizing and both within the league and outside
of it? I think in the league, I think there's this big mental barrier is on your brain, and it physically handcuffs you from having this, being the man that you want to be, because you're living in a world where, you know, an instant world like Instagram, Twitter, all these different things that want to keep you in the box, and this is the way to do it. Like, you got to post like this, you got to be like this, or society's not going to accept you for who you are. And for me, I just want to show them, like, boom, break those barriers. You know, who cares about, you know, if Nike wants to work with you, or if this brand wants to work with you, this brand. At the end of the day, all you got is your being. All you got at the end of the day, when you're done playing football, those teams, those organizations aren't going to care about you. Those brands aren't going to care about you. They're going to move to the next guy who can jump higher, the next guy who's faster, the next guy who got the most followers. So to not have your voice and look back in your life and have regret for not being the man that you wanted to be, or be able to respect your community the way that you're supposed to, you're really losing. And that's not what a true champion is. A true champion is a person who can stand the test of time, withstand that criticism of the world. Because when you out there and you playing, we've been in the biggest stadiums, we've been in the crowds and Super Bowls, everything, when people didn't believe in us. And why now the people who believe in us in our community that wanted us to make it this far, and now they're looking back at us for us to give them hope, to be fearful? I just think that's just coward. That's a coward to me personally. So I ran to a lot of people that I had respect for, that I lost a little respect for. But then it took me a little while to, you know, do more reading and do more deeper understanding of people and the thought process and the brain, how people react to certain things. And it challenged myself to allow other people to grow at their own rate. Maybe at that moment they weren't ready for that growth. And as a leader, you got to be able to let people grow when they need to grow, because their voice and their moment, this might not be their moment. You know, I would love it for them to be their moment and love them to have that voice, but they're not ready for it yet. So sometimes other people got to go through spiritual growth, and they got to go through their own stuff, their own studying, their own educating themselves to have their voice. Oh, but I would like them to have that moment. The time that I get into their face and fist up is a time that they're going to fist up too. I actually want the opposite. I actually want them to have their hearts open so we can share a message and be able to grow together. So that's what I had to learn too, because at first it was just like, I was just like, damn, like, yeah. And then I had to like do my own thing. And so I had to dig deeper into that, and even dig deeper into the same empathy and compassion that I have for people who don't have a voice. I should have the same empathy and compassion for people who do have a voice but aren't ready to use it yet.
Yeah. You know, In reading, you know, your book, I read what I think was more than a subtext of a critique of capitalism and the commodification, not only of NFL players, but the way corporations exploit people in all kinds of contexts in the United States and around the world. And you talk a lot about branding and the role of branding and how players begin to think of themselves as commodities. You write, we have the right to protest, and we, like anyone else, can try to be heard. They tell us to stick to sports when we speak out on issues, but they don't seem to have a problem when we're making commercials, selling their kids sneakers they can't afford, or fast food that will give them colon cancer. And you talk about the need for athletes to begin to think of themselves as human beings and not as brands, even though you refer to your bosses as your owners, to reclaim your own dignity.
I think it's definitely about reclaiming your dignity and reclaiming your own humanity, because I think for a while, if you live in a certain, I feel like it's a certain type of abuse. It's a certain type of abuse on their own psyche. Like, they've been abused in their own psyche, that they've been trained to want to be a brand, trained to open themselves up, and trained to, this is how you got to do it. And it's like, there has to be a breaking down of this, the psychological thinking that I don't have a voice, I can't have that brand, I don't have this. And it's like, I feel like brands will do what society allows them to do. So if we start to change the way that we shop or change the way that we allow brands to think. If you look at what happened to Starbucks, if you look to Nike trying to do with Colin Kaepernick, that was only because the people started to change that. And if the people are led by people who are in those positions to change brands, then the brands have no reason or no way, because at the end of the day, they're capitalism. They're about capital, and they want to find out the way to capital gain. So if social justice is not as cool, then they're going to try to make it cool. So it's like, we got to be able to break those barriers down and show them, like, you want to change that, but we going to stay the course. We're going to stay the course. And I think sometimes when you've been physically abused, you don't know how to stay the course, because everything about you've been broken down. So a lot of these young guys, they've been caught since they was babies. They've been taught to think like this since they was babies. And a lot of them don't have fathers. They don't have mothers. They come from broken homes. They're dealing with the type of trauma that a coach can't understand. They don't understand what it's like when a kid's been in a foster care, or a 15-year-old, a child is having a child. Like, they can't understand that type of trauma, what it brings on a person. So a lot of times these kids, they've been manipulated to think a certain way, and unless they have the leadership to show them not to think like that, they're going to continuously let people use them, continuously let brands persuade them to be a certain way. And then in the end, like I said, they're going to be the ones who look like fools when they look back in time. And they're like, oh, I wish I could have been like John Carlos. Oh, I could have been like Muhammad Ali. Or I could have been like Jim Brown. And the opportunities are now. Opportunities to have the type of change in society is right now. There's no moment bigger than the moment that we're living in now, right now, and that's only because it's now. It's not because it's the future, it's because it's now. And I think that's important that we continuously show young people how to do that.
Yeah, it's a challenge, you know, to say the least. I think, you know, one of the things I was talking about earlier today actually with Derica Purnell, who's a scholar and writer and activist, who's, you know, speaking about how this phenomenon of branding and people kind of viewing themselves as brand isn't limited to the NFL, even in movement work and activism. You know, you can find activists who are trying to promote themselves as a brand on social media for the purposes of getting more funding or more support. And there's a way in which capitalism conditions us to view ourselves as commodities and to promote ourselves as such. And you mentioned Nike, which I think is kind of an interesting example, obviously, given the way Nike kind of co-opted the message of the, you know, anthem protest with their slogan that they used for, you know, Colin's campaign, believe in something even if it means sacrificing everything. I'm wondering how you feel about that, kind of the role of corporations.
But I do think when you talk about branding is such a strong thing. There's a reason why when they brought slaves over here, they branded them, because that represents something. When you brand yourself, it's a part of your identity, it's a part of your soul. So you got to be careful when people are trying to brand you a certain way. And I think when you think about what Nike was doing, what they were doing was basically, you know, making it cool to be social. So it's like, I feel like businesses don't have souls. I feel like the NFL doesn't operate with a soul. I feel like companies don't operate with souls, because at the end of the day, they're about money. So when a company takes the opportunity to try to change, I just feel a certain way, because if we're going to look at it from one perspective of America, then we got to look at it from intersectional perspective of where the shoe is being made and how are people, the money being distributed to people who are making the shoes. How are fair wages practiced? It's it's a deeper rooted issue than just the one thing with Colin Kaepernick. It goes deeper to the whole essence of what it is to be free, or what is the essence of other people's existence too, not just one singular thought.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk a lot about corporate exploitation in the book. You mentioned that your father worked at Enron during the time of its implosion, its collapse as a result of, you know, insatiable corporate greed, and that, you know, Enron collapsed when you were 15, I think, 15 years old, and that, you know, the NFL and the NCAA, you know, profit, you know, especially the NCAA in terms of profiting off of young people getting beat up for free. And
I think that was the hardest chapter to write, because it was like such a reality check for myself. As the pen hit the page and the words started to come out of my spirit and they started to speak, I started to look at them, and then like, damn, this shit is like this shit is like gospel. Like, you know, when my friends look at this and they read it, they're like, bro, like, you talking about me. Like, every single athlete that I run to, they, like, you talk about me. You talk about the depression. You talk about losing my identity. You talk about all these different things. I feel like you were talking to me. And so it's like, it's hard to, like, pick a young kid and put him in that situation and expect him to have the wherewithal to survive there, you know, to take a black kid out of a predominantly black neighborhood and put him into a white society, although America's white, but just take, to go from, you know, from being in A-Leaf to being in College Station where, you know, I go from being a majority to a minority, 1%, and you expecting them to have this certain outlook on life. It's just hard when you talk about college athletes, when they lose their identity, they don't get any money. It's like all these different things, and then you put injury on top of that. You know, it's, sports is a hard thing because it's one of the rare jobs that, you know, where it's mentally and physically taxing, and then you got to face the world every single day with criticism. So that does something to somebody. It's a, you got to really put everything into it. As a young kid, when you're in college, and you got to put everything into it, and on top of that, your family's looking back at you like, you better make it. Like, that's, we need you to make it. Like, that type of thing, when you, you know, when I look at my kids, I don't look at them and expect them to be the breadwinner for my family. I expect them to be kids. So a lot of times these athletes, their parents don't look at them like that. They look at them as the breadwinner from their families. So that's a lot of trauma. And I think a lot of times in the collegiate sports, they don't look into that type of stuff. They don't know how to connect with people because a lot of these schools aren't built like that. They aren't built from those communities. They don't have that grassroots connection to the kids.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what you think the answer is to this. In your book, you seem to have kind of two strands of thought about it. On the one hand, you argue for kind of black ownership within the NFL, and you argue that, you know, until we own our own teams and gain control over, you know, our own labor and our own you know, properties, that we won't truly be free. And on the other hand, you talk a lot about the importance of collectivism. And you talk about how you wore, you know, a Bernie Sanders hat around the locker room during the run-up to the 2016 election. And I'm curious, you know, are you viewing kind of the pathway that you're supporting through your own philanthropy and your own activism as primarily kind of one of trying to reform kind of the way capitalism functions, the way the NFL functions? Are you looking for some other alternative democratic socialism or some hybrid of all of them?
I think there's a hybrid of all of them. I think there is, like, for NCAA, if a kid's going to play and the college is going to make a certain amount of money, then I feel like there should be some type of 401k or some type of IRA, something for a kid that when he's done that he can have later on. Maybe it's not when he's 25, but when he's 40, he gets that money. You know, I know there's people who play college sports and they end up with injuries, but they also end up with the bill. Like, when you 22 and you got an injury that can handicap you for the rest of your life and you don't have a way to, you know, deal with that, and the schools don't pay for it. So it's got to be some type of collective universal care for the players too when they leave college. There is a certain 5-year period for the NFL, but I know the college level doesn't have that. And I think for professional sports, it just has to be able to, I wish there could be a black-owned NFL league, but I don't think that could possibly happen because these teams, and it's not just the team, but the team is the city, and the city is the lights, and the lights is the garbage, and it's so much deeper than just owning the NFL team. It's like when you're a part of it, it's a reason why, you know, teams bid on that. It's the reason why cities bid on the Super Bowl, bid on the Pro Bowl, because it brings so much money. But I do think there's a way that players can get some type of ownership. I think you look at baseball, the things that they're trying to do with their contract, I think there's an opportunity for NFL players to do the same thing.
Yeah, so one of your big passions is around food justice.
Yeah. Food apartheid, that's what it's been.
Yes. Called. Can you say a little bit about how you got interested in food justice? I found the story that you tell about showing up to that kind of government convening where Pepsi and Coca-Cola and McDonald's were there, and how that kind of awakened you to the necessity of...
You know, when I was telling somebody the other day, like, when you grow up in, like, a food apartheid. Like, you don't really know that's going on. Like, you don't know that you're living there until you've been taken out that situation. And I think I didn't really realize it that, you know, like, oh, I was like, oh, there's Popeye's right here. Like, there's churches right here. This is the liquor store. Like, that was just the places that we ate. We didn't really understand that there wasn't, you know, access to fresh food. That wasn't really the thing that...
The grocery store was farther.
Yeah. Like, you know, my mom had to go farther. Like, there's people... It's just, I didn't really understand that concept at that time, but now I look back, I'm like, oh, I was living in that. I was a part of that. I had become so numb to it because that was my reality. That was a part of my reality. And so when I got to the NFL and I really started to dig deep into food, I got invited to this meeting, and it was just a lot of people from the government, and we were talking about, like, how are we going to change food in Hawaii, because I had been pulled out of my element. I was in Hawaii and I was learning about the indigenous people in Hawaii. I started learning about the things that they were dealing with their diets, the obesity and diabetes and all these different things that were happening to them, the diseases that were happening to them because of food. And so I was there and I was just like, dude, I'm like, why is Coca-Cola here? Like, you're the problem, you know? Like, McDonald's, like, yeah, like, you're serving a 50-ounce Sprite, like, they're going to buy that. Like, so it was like, it was one of those things that I had ended up meeting with a lot of people, and I feel like I had just decided to take a stand right there. And I was like, nah, I'm one of those kids that you guys are talking about. I'm one of those kids that who didn't have the opportunity, who didn't learn to get a chance to learn about nutrition. Because what I've really learned about people is that people are resilient. Like, whenever I go to places and, you know, it's funny, I was talking to a friend, no, he's actually right here. We ended up being friends over through Senegal, and we were talking the other day about resilience, and he was talking about the farms and what people are doing in Africa, and when I saw in Africa, what my families, all these people seeing, like, these kids are walking miles to get to school, these kids are doing whatever they can to survive, but given the opportunity, and I realized that we weren't giving the kids the opportunity, or we didn't believe in their resilience to want to change, and for me, that was what I wanted to do with my voice, is to share that with people, and make sure that when I was in that meeting, I wanted them to resonate with my culture and what I felt for those kids and how I can do that. And that's really how my story became with food justice and being a part of that. And I really didn't, well, then I started to learn that it's a food apartheid, because food justice, food apartheid means it's forced, it's not choice. Somebody gave me a whole dissertation about that. So she said, next time you're on stage, Michael, say food apartheid. I'm going to be watching you. So I said food apartheid.
Yes.
So now we do so much stuff for, like, so, you know, and I had to learn about, and through that process, it's a learning process, because now I was learning about the kids who didn't have food, and, like, you know, now I built the program where we had to give kids, the only meal the kids were getting was the meal that we were providing for them, you know, and after school in the summertime, I was like, whoa, oh, I didn't realize that when school is over, like, these kids, they're not eating, the only meal that they were getting was from school, so we had to build a whole program around that to be able to feed kids in the summertime so they can have food and be able to help them eat, and then that's where I started getting into the gardens. It's a whole little story. But then that's when I started getting to the gardens, and I started going into communities and building gardens, and then going to schools and building gardens, and then going to juvenile detention centers. But the juvenile detention center, to me, was the biggest change, because it wasn't just about the food for the kids. It was about the first time that they had ownership in something. It was the first time that they felt like they had, that somebody cared about them and they cared about something. You know, those kids, a lot of those kids, they had dealt with traumas that I could never deal with as a kid, the things that I thought that I dealt with were not even in the same level. Now they're in prison or they're going to jail. But this garden, this food, what they did when they put their hand in the soil, what it did to them when I went back every week and seeing them and till them, eating them with them, and just cooking with them, it just changed their whole perspective, and I realized what food can do for people and culture.
Yeah. Well, people have been waving signs at me telling me that I need to let the audience have a chance, but I have one more thing I really want to talk with you about. I was deeply moved by the part of your book where you talk about your family, the love that you have for your family, for your daughters who helped to awaken you to the need to speak out about toxic masculinity and to support women's rights and to take a stand against sexual violence, and also your relationship with your birth mother and the need that you have felt to forgive her. And I wonder if you would share with us a little bit about
how your journey to healing in your own family is connected to the work that you're striving to do in the world.
One second, let me get myself together real quick.
It's kind of difficult because you know when you out doing all these different things and you're doing the world and then you taking stance on for certain issues that are happening, you facing criticism and you have all this courage, but then you look back in the mirror and you just like, I haven't even conquered my own fears or my own traumas that are happening to me and like my own things that have happened in my past life. And I felt like the thing of my mother was the biggest issue that I felt like I ever had to deal with, because it was one of those things that, you know, as a child, just, give me a second.
We don't have to go there.
No, it's one of those things that, I mean, I still get teared up because this was such a big thing in my life, because, you know, I always felt like, I ain't getting emotional, but every time I think about it, it was just a big moment in my life. Like, I feel like it was the biggest moment. All the things I've ever been through, even like taking a stance in the national anthem, like police brutality, that was the biggest.
I feel like that was the biggest issue I ever had to face, because it was my own reality. It was my own trauma. It was not everything, because here's, as you read my book, I was just dealing with having this regret about all these things, about not connecting with my mom and not having that true openness to the woman who birthed me. And I just felt like this love and compassion that I got for people, why can't I have that for my mother, and why can't I forgive her for the things that have happened to the past, why can't I take those steps to grow? And I felt like for me those were the biggest things ever. And it was like finally having that sit down and talk with my mom and expressing my pain and expressing what I felt like it was like the biggest burden. I feel, to me, that was like the Super Bowl of my whole life, because it was like I finally got a chance to be the man that I wanted to be, so it was good.
Would you mind reading the last two paragraphs of your book?
Can you do it for me?
You say the need to forgive is a precondition for achieving justice. You want me to read it for you? He writes, I can forgive anyone for anything they have said or done, or that their ancestors said or did, as long as they are willing to work with me to make sure today's version of Jim Crow, from mass incarceration to inferior access to education and nutrition to police violence, gets beaten back. There is a need to forgive but never forget, because if we are not honest about the past, we will never change our present or future. If it makes some people uncomfortable, then that's the price of change. It's not comfortable to confront the part of our history that makes us feel shame. It's not comfortable for me to sit for the anthem while people boo. It's not comfortable to lose sponsors or give away endorsements. It's not comfortable to go to the parts of the world or parts of this country where suffering is a way of life. But guess what? You have to be uncomfortable to grow. When you grow as a child, it's so intense that your body is knocking your own teeth out of your mouth so stronger, better teeth can grow in. When your bones are growing, when you're 12, 13 years old, it can be so uncomfortable you can't sleep at night. If we feel uncomfortable, we are doing something right. That discomfort is just a period of transition. It's not comfortable to see people in Flint, Michigan without clean water. It's not comfortable to see Philando Castile's murder at the hands of police live-streamed on Facebook. It's not comfortable to hear gymnasts tell their stories of being sexually assaulted. It's not comfortable to talk about CTE. It's not comfortable seeing kids too tired to move. But the ultimate question is, what are you going to do? Are you going to lay it on the line? Are you going to be a change maker? Remember what John Carlos said, there's no partial commitment to justice. You are either in or you're out. Trust me, If you're willing to be uncomfortable, you will also feel blessed if you can see it through and make it to the other side. Robin, you have, yeah?
Turned up. Can you hear me now? Okay, there we go. All right, so we're going to go through some of these questions. We'll try to get through as many as we can. We have about 20, 25 minutes. So the first question is Aya Zaki.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Michael, and thank you for steering the conversation, Michelle. I have a longish question. Do you feel a moral inconsistency when it comes to being active in the community off the field and answering to the likes of like Robert Kraft and your new quarterback, Tom Brady, who have both been avid supporters of Donald Trump and of Zionism, which is racist in nature? If so, how do you reconcile your work off the field with your professional responsibilities in a way that doesn't make you feel like your bosses are your owners?
I don't feel any moral. I feel like my moral compass is exactly the same regardless of the system that I'm in or the team that I'm on, the people that I work with. My moral compass is going to stay the same because it's my journey, the stories that I believe in. Their journeys is their journeys. But at the same time, I get what you're saying, but it's like I live in America and there's this racial construct of the whole life. But at the same time, my Buddhist teacher, I mean, my yoga teacher always say, like, there's darkness, but you got to see light. And I feel like in this situation, I got to see the light in the situation and keep moving forward and let my growth be my growth. And regardless of what they're trying to do, I'm still going to have the connection to the community because the first thing I do when I go to the city, I find the grassroots organizers and I try to find a way to connect with them. And I think that's important because the real work isn't the one that's being highlighted on TV. It's the stuff that you do behind the scenes. And the reason that you do it is not because you want the glorification, but because you want to help them. And I think being on the Patriots or being on the Eagles or being on the Seattle, I've always demanded my respect because of the man that I am and what I believe in. And regardless of what they say, I stay true to it. So over time, they got to stay true to what, they got to start falling in line on my beliefs.
Is there a gentleman named Burl?
Mr. Bennett, thank you for coming, sir, and I really appreciate your talk. My question is, let me just sort of preface it by saying that as you and Mr. Kaepernick were kneeling and protesting the abuse of African Americans with the police and so forth, I would get into a lot of debates with people around me. And oftentimes they would say that those athletes, they really don't give a daggone about you guys. They're a bunch of rich people who, when their careers are down and out, they would say that about Kaepernick a lot, that his career was over and that he's just trying to do something now to stay in the spotlight and so forth. So my question is to you is that I'm sure you've heard that. And when you hear that African-American athletes are a bunch of spoiled individuals who are just trying to gain the system, take advantage of the system, how do you respond to that, sir?
I feel like that's fuel to my fire, honestly. I feel like their criticism is nothing but a true answer to why we're doing what we're doing. Because when they start to criticize, we know that there's change that needs to be made. So all that does is add more fuel to us doing more things in the community, more connection with each other. Because at the end of the day, we're not just doing it for those people to change their perspective, but we're also doing it for the kids. And it was never about the people who didn't listen to us. We want to make their change, but also it's about the people for the young kids. So for me, I didn't really care what they were saying because they're always saying something. They say something, we miss a catch. They say something, we miss a tackle. So they're always going to be saying something. There's always going to be somebody criticizing you, but the people who criticize the most are the people who are the most fearful to stand up on anything they believe in. They're fearful to say what they want to eat. They're fearful to walk down the street. They don't have the courage to change society for their kids because they already see society as the best that it could possibly be. And for us to be in this stage, I actually think that having everything in the world and still making a stance says something even more about a person's dignity and their courage.
We have Tiana Hill.
Hi, I'm a student here at Union. In our classes, a lot of times we talk about everything that you're talking about all the time, right? But, you know, this is a predominantly white institution. I'm usually one of only a few black people, black women in the classroom. So I'm always stuck with the question of, you know, we all want to leave here and do this work and contribute to whatever we're passionate about within, like, the social justice realm. But it's a two-part question, pretty small, but how do you take measures to protect yourself and your family while you're contributing towards this work? But also, how do I, a black woman who doesn't have, you know, a celebrity platform, like, how can I protect myself? Because my friends who may not look like me, you know, it's a little different with them doing the work versus with me doing the work. I'm treated differently and targeted in a different way. So how do I go about protecting myself while fighting justice?
Oh, that's a good question. You got the answer for that?
No.
I don't have an answer for that.
I mean, I'm curious what you would say. I mean, I think, unfortunately, there often isn't a way to be sure that you're protecting yourself. You can have circles of support in the work, which can help to fortify your courage, and you can be open and honest with the people you love and care about the risks that you're taking. But often, the nature of the work requires putting yourself at risk and acting with courage even when you cannot protect yourself from the kinds of responses you're likely to receive.
I agree with you. You're the expert.
Reverend John Vaughn.
My soul has hungered for this all of my life as a lifelong athlete, so I'm really appreciative of this, Brother Michael, for being here. All right, so two-part question. Why do you think that we don't hear more about the ways that faith inspires and shapes activism in sports? And why is there not more organizing, or at least it seems to be organizing, of athletes around racial activism?
I think there is faith in sports, but I feel like the faith that we have in sports is kind of like, it's almost like a ritual. It's like, it just becomes a habit, like we pray, but the prayer doesn't really have any substance. Or we say something, like it's not really something that really has substance. We don't really pray for a change, or we don't come together and talk about what we can do through faith, because I feel like sometimes religion is used as a passive-aggressive type thing instead of being aggressive with change and being out there and say what the church is supposed to do. Like when I read the Martin Luther King books and I'm looking at the Montgomery Boy Buscott, I'm looking and reading, and he's saying that, like, he didn't go to the stores, he didn't go to the movie theaters, he went to the church, and he went to the church, and what church helped him get the word out and get the voice out. So I feel like in sports, we don't have that type of connection to God. We just our prayer is to win the game. Our prayer is not to change the world. And I do think there is a lot of people who are doing a lot of things that are collaborating and making changes. Athletes for Impact, there's a lot of different groups that are organizing. But I don't think it's at a massive scale, because it's really not this generation who's going to be the people who do the change. It's really going to be the young kids after us, because now we're giving them the tools. We're giving them the template to find the groups, to create their own organization. And if you look at society right now, it's a lot of young kids who are the ones who are doing things. You look at the Parkland shooting, you look at anything that's happening right now. Me too, it's young kids who are standing up on what they believe in, because they're starting to feel that place where they feel like it's okay for them to have a voice. And it starts with the older people. The older people are starting to give them their voice and their way to say, this is your world. We had our turn and we fucked it up. Now you have your turn, now change it.
Greg Smith.
Good evening, and hello, Michelle.
Hello.
Mr. Bennett, my question is twofold, and I purposely brought my son tonight because I wanted him to be in your presence as well, very much like Michelle's son wanted to meet you. My question emanates from the world in which you traffic in, which is playing in the NFL, and I appreciate the fact that you supported Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, and you took the baton and went along with it as well. I wanted to know, though, with regard to how it's perceived now, I always thought that the person in our White House took over and changed the narrative, and so we who were in support of why you kneeled and why everyone kneeled got co-opted by him, and so the narrative changed. That's part of my question. The other one is based on, I find that it's analogous to lynching, where if when we're discussing lynching, we end up asking a bunch of black people about lynching as opposed to the white people who are also doing the lynching and are supporting it, and or if they too disagree with lynching, why aren't they also addressing it? Very much like your teammates, your sport is predominantly African American. Your teammates are with you side by side in all the tackles. Your issue about taking your knee, you don't have the support of your white players as well, as if the same thing doesn't apply to them.
Actually, you write about how you did experience the support of some.
Yeah, I did. I think there was a lot of white players that I felt like who were courageous, and I felt like it was one of those things that a lot of the players, some of the white players, they grew up in places and they didn't really have black people in their communities, and it was their opportunity for them to listen. Like, you know, there was a lot of teammates when we had our team meeting and we started to confess and started to say things that happened to us, they were overwhelmed. They had tears coming out their eyes. They had compassion, and a lot of them took stands. I think if you look at our team, there's a lot of white guys who were taking stance and said things that they believe in because they trusted us and they believed in our stories and they started to do their own research. But, I mean, I don't know. I think it's important that somebody of the opposite who isn't experiencing the trauma to be able to share the message to help the people who are experiencing the trauma to have a big platform. So I do think white athletes have a big responsibility of using their platform to share the message, just like men have a big responsibility of showing the things that are happening in the feminist movement to make sure that we are standing tall right next to our sisters and our wives and our mothers to make sure they have a voice. And I think that's important for white athletes to do the same. But I think it's happening. There's a lot of guys who are doing the steps, and a lot of times those white athletes were also feeling not the criticism from the black players, but the criticism for their white family, their other counterparts from the towns that they were. So a lot of guys that we dealt with, like, you know, some people, like my dad said, if I do this, he's not going to talk to me again. So that comes with a lot of courage. And I think as a society, the people who do take the stands, not just the black players, but the players from the other side who do take the stands, we should applaud them and help them go through their traumas as they take that stance too, because their stance is a different type of stance there, but at the same time, they're making one. And I think that's important that we acknowledge the guys who are doing that.
Jenny Kim.
Mr. Bennett and Ms. Alexander, it's truly an honor to be here. So speaking of uncomfortable but necessary conversation, after generations of not talking about effects of slavery, Jim Crow, redlining, and so much more, we're finally talking about reparation. Do you support reparation? And if so, what form should it take? And what should it address?
Oh, this is a good question, because I was in New Zealand and one of my friends, they make movies, and we were there and we were talking about, because they're in New Zealand and they're talking about reparations in America. Like, we're watching reparations in America, what do you think? And I told them, I said that I don't feel like reparations is money, because the things that were taken from us, money can't replace. Money can't replace culture. Money can't replace the amount of lives that were lost. Money can't replace, you know, dignity. Money can't replace broken families and losing husbands and losing mothers and being just tortured and doing all these different things. So I don't think money is the answer for that. I think, I don't know how you acknowledge it, but I think giving money to something like that is almost like, when you take money from something, it's almost like you saying, we settled. And I feel like that debt can't be settled. We lost a lot of people. We lost a lot of great people. So I don't think that money is not the answer. I think money, people trying to say, oh, give them $40,000. No, that time was gone. That time for that. After we finished slavery, we had another hurdle. We had to go through this. Then after that hurdle, we had another hurdle. Now we're dealing with more hurdles. So the money, I feel like the only way you can really fix the system is to give everybody a fair shot. I'm saying that we all line up at the line. And if you give us the same opportunity as a white person and we win at the end, let us win. That's what I'm saying. I feel like that's what reparation is the fair equality to give us the same books, the same water, the same food, and see how we come out at the end.
But do you view, I'm curious about this, though. You know, I have trouble with the metaphor of life being a race or a competition.
I was born in competition.
All right.
Well, when I say competition, I'm saying, like...
You know, like,
I mean,
what does winning mean? You know?
When I say fairness, I mean, like, that we... Why we always have to be the first at something? Like, mm-hmm. If we had the same opportunities, we wouldn't have a first. We would have people just continuously being the deans, or people being the president, people being all these different things, because they'll have the fair opportunity. That's all I'm saying. I feel like that's what the reparation is, just to finally saying that we're going to have fairness and equality. We don't need affirmative action, because the action of us getting a fair education, we've proved that we learned and we're ready for the opportunity. But I feel because we haven't had that opportunity, giving us money but not giving us the foundation to survive is just another way of keeping us in the cycle.
Yes, having a payout without actually restructuring the system in a way that, you know, ensures that people actually have basic human rights
and equal human opportunity
is a payout to continue living with an unjust system.
Yeah, I feel like if I took some money because my ancestors, like, I don't know if I could, like, really look them in the eye in the end and be like, oh, I took $40,000 for what you went through. That would be like, you did what? like they'd be looking at me like, you did, no.
Mm-hmm.
It was never about that. We survived. We survived so you can have that voice. We survived so you can be the man that you are. We survived. So that's really the thing that I think is important, that they survive so we can survive to continuously pave a new way for our kids to have a different opportunity than they had and the opportunity that we had.
Do you think there's a role for the government to, as part of an effort to repair harm done as a result of the legacy of slavery, to invest heavily in communities that are most disadvantaged and to target those investments in a way that is designed to repair harm of decades of segregation, centuries of racial oppression?
I think the investment should be into schools.
Mm-hmm.
Because I teach African Americans at my kids' school, African American history every year at my kids' school, and the facial reaction, the respect from other students when they understand somebody else's contribution to society changes everything about them. I think a lot of times people don't even know the contribution of African Americans to the history of America and how we built America and what we did to have this. Like, to have white people understand that, that's a whole nother, to have other people understand what Hispanic people did or Native Americans did to have their contribution to society is a big thing. And I think the lack of history for other people in schools is sad. When we go to school, we learn about Christopher Columbus. We don't learn about the people before him or what they did to society. So we start off in the construct of hate. We start off with it. When we start off with the things that they teach us, we're automatically starting off with not just a hate for the history, but a hate for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We start off with, you know, exactly what happened and this and that, but it's never the truth. And I feel like we need to have education. It's like, why do we have to go to African American school to learn about African American history? That should be a part of American history because it is American history.
Yes. All right. Fortunately, we could talk for a long time just about reparations.
Reparation.
I'm getting warmed up. But I'm told I have to close. But
yeah.
I just want to say how deeply thankful I am for your presence. I know we are all greatly appreciative of you being here. And your books are for sale. I highly recommend that folks pick up the books. Books are for sale in the lobby, and if you want them signed, you need to buy them there and then come to the stage for them.
Before I go, I want to, Anthony, can you stand up?
No.
I want to give Anthony, like, when you're an athlete and you want to write a book, everybody wants you to write a book about sports. When I came to him, I said, Anthony, I want to write a book about politics, and he said, I believe you.
Thank you very, very much. Can we all say a very warm thank you to Michael Bennett for being here tonight? Thank you. In 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. As of 2004, more black men were disenfranchised than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, of course, during the Jim Crow era, poll taxes and literacy tests operated to keep black folks from the polls. Well, today, felon disenfranchisement laws accomplish in a number of states what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. And this phenomenon of mass incarceration doesn't affect just some small segment of the African American community. No, the contrary. In many large urban areas today, more than half of working age African American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In cities like Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, the statistics are far worse. In fact, a report was released in Chicago showing that if you take into account prisoners, in fact, like if you count prisoners as people, as human beings, worthy of being counted, and, you know, prisoners are excluded from poverty statistics and unemployment data, now, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you actually count prisoners as people in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working-age African-American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I find that when I tell people today that I now believe that our system of mass incarceration operates more like a racial caste system than a system of crime prevention or control, that I now believe it is, much like a new Jim Crow, people will react with just shocked disbelief. They'll say, what are you talking about? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control, it's a system of crime control. And if black folks would just stop running around committing so many crimes, they wouldn't have to worry about being rounded up en masse and then stripped of their basic civil and human rights. But therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's just not true. During a 30-year period of time, our prison population quintupled
in 30 years. We went from a prison population of about 350,000 to now well over 2 million. We now have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, a penal system unprecedented in world history. But this can't be explained simply by crime or crime rates. During that same 30-year period of time, crime rates in the United States fluctuated. They went up, went down, went back up again, went down again. And today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, crime rates nationally are at historical lows. But incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime was going up or going down in any given community or the nation as a whole. So what accounts for this sudden, unprecedented explosion in incarceration of not crime and crime rates? Well, the answer is the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, the wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. Drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for about two-thirds of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000, the period of our prison system's most dramatic expansion. Drug convictions have increased more than 1,000% since the drug war began in the early 80s. I mean, to get a sense of how large a contribution the drug war has made to mass incarceration, consider this. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. Most do. That's a fact. But the enemy in this war has been racially defined. Not by accident, the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown now for decades that contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, or sell. Now that defies our basic racial stereotypes about who a drug dealer is. You know, if you ask most Americans, to be honest, who do you picture? You picture a drug dealer, they'll tell you, if they're honest, they picture some black kid standing in a street corner with his pants hanging down. Now, plenty of drug dealing happens in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. You know, white kids living in rural Oregon or Nebraska don't drive to the hood to get their marijuana or their meth or their cocaine or their ecstasy. No, they get it from someone most likely of their own race down the road. Drug dealing and drug use happens in all communities of all colors, but those who do time for drug crime are overwhelmingly black and brown. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. And this is despite the fact that the studies show that where significant differences in the data appear, frequently suggests that white youth are more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. And yet it is young black men who have overwhelmingly been the target in the drug war and who are the ones doing time. Now, I find that when people actually see the data, they'll say, oh, yeah, that's a shame, you know. That's a shame, but, you know, we need a drug war against them and those communities because that's where the violent offenders are and that's where the drug kingpins can be found. We need a war against them. In fact, in my experience, many people imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities and the related violence. And for a long while, I believed that too. But that's not the case. The current drug war was declared in 1982 by President Ronald Reagan at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. It was before, not after, crack began to ravage inner city communities. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term, a war on drugs. But President Ronald Reagan made that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise, and less than 3% of the American population even identified drugs as the nation's most pressing concern. So why declare a war, an all-out war, when drug crime is actually on the decline and the American population isn't much concerned about it? Well, from the outset, the war on drugs had relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug addiction or drug abuse, and much to do with politics, racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented that the war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded get tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were anxious about, resentful of, fearful of many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Now, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that poor and working class whites in the South really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. You know, wealthy whites could send their kids to private schools, give their kids all of the advantages that wealth has to offer. But poor and working class whites were faced with a social demotion. You know, it was their kids who might be bused across town to go to a school they believed was inferior. It was their kids and themselves who were forced to compete on equal terms for limited jobs with this whole new group of people they've been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them. And then to make matters worse, from their perspective, affirmative action programs created the perception that black folks were now leapfrogging over them, you know, on their way to Ivy League schools or fancy jobs in corporate America. And this state of affairs created an enormous amount of fear, anger, anxiety, resentment, but it also created an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group not so subtly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. In the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he described the strategy as, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. A couple years after crack hit the streets, a drug war, which had already been declared, got revved up. A couple years after crack hit the streets, this drug war revved up. The Reagan administration seized on the emergence of crack cocaine with some glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, the so-called crack whores, and crack-related violence, in an effort to make crack a media sensation, which they believed would bolster public support for a drug war they had already declared and persuade Congress to devote millions more dollars to waging it. The media frenzy around crack cocaine didn't just happen. It wasn't the product of just good investigative journalism. It was the product of a political campaign, a media campaign launched by the Reagan administration to bolster drug support for their drug war. And the plan worked like a charm. Almost overnight, television sets were saturated with images of black and brown drug users and dealers and crack babies and the so-called crack whores. And a wave of punitiveness washed over the United States. Legislatures began passing harsh mandatory minimum sentences. Congress passed harsh mandatory minimum sentences for minor drug offenses, sentences longer, harsher than murderers receive in many other Western democracies. And soon Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them. than their Republican counterparts. And so it was President Bill Clinton who escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. And it was the Clinton administration that championed laws banning drug offenders from federal financial aid for schooling upon their release, banning drug offenders and people with criminal records from public housing. It was the Clinton administration that championed a federal law banning drug offenders, people convicted of drug felonies, from food stamps for life. To a large extent, many of these rules, laws, policies, and practices that now comprise this new caste system were championed by a Democratic administration desperate to win back those so-called white swing voters, the folks who had defected from the Democratic Party in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement. But still, I find that even people who know this history will say, well, that's unfortunate, but don't we still need to get tough on them, those violent offenders, those drug kingpins? What people don't realize is this drug war has never been aimed primarily at rooting out the violent offenders or the drug kingpins. Federal funding has flowed to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost the volume of drug arrests. It's been a numbers game. State and local law enforcement agencies have been rewarded in cash by the millions for the sheer numbers of people they sweep into the system for drug offenses. And to make matters worse, federal drug forfeiture laws allow state and local law enforcement agencies to keep, for their own use, up to 80% of the cash, cars, homes seized from suspected drug offenders. You don't have to be convicted, just suspected of a drug offense, and the police can take your cash, take your car, thus granting to law enforcement a direct monetary interest, not in ending drug abuse or drug crime, but a direct monetary interest in the longevity of this war itself. And the results have been predictable. The overwhelming majority of folks arrested in the drug war have been arrested for minor, nonviolent drug offenses. For example, in 2005, 4 out of 5 drug arrests for simple possession, only 1 out of 5 for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or even significant selling activity. And in the 1990s, the Clinton years, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, a drug that's now been shown to be less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this drug war almost exclusively in the hood, we've created a vast new racial undercast in an astonishingly short period of time. Now, many people say to me, well, why not just file a big lawsuit about this? If it's as bad as you say, why aren't there lawsuits being filed to address this? What people don't realize is that the U.S. Supreme Court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. Those racial profiling cases that I was bringing at the end of the 90s can't even file today. Those cases can't even be brought anymore. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a series of cases beginning with McCleskey versus Kemp and Armstrong versus the United States, has ruled explicitly that it does not matter how overwhelming your statistical evidence is. It does not matter how severe the racial disparities are. Unless you can offer proof of conscious intentional bias by a law enforcement official, tantamount to an admission, you can't even state a claim for racial bias in the criminal justice system today. Now, as a practical matter, that makes it next to impossible to bring these cases, because most police officers know better than to say, well, yes, Your Honor, I stopped him because he was black. most police officers know better than to say, yeah, I searched him. Well, you know, he looked like he was up to no good. You know, he's a black kid in that part of town. No. Most prosecutors won't say, oh, I would have given him a better plea deal, but he didn't look to me like he was worth a second chance. I mean, look, he's a black kid. He looks like he isn't going anywhere. No. Most people do not admit their racial biases and stereotypes out loud, but what is more important is that so many of the biases and stereotypes that drive discretionary decision-making by law enforcement operate on such an unconscious level that many well-meaning, well-intentioned officers can't even admit to themselves their biases if they tried. You know, a well-meaning officer sees a group of young black kids walking down the streets, pants sagging down, and the officer thinks to himself, oh, I'm going to jump out, check these kids, see what they're up to, frisk them, see if they got anything on them, thinking they're doing their job, aggressive police work. Now, that same officer seeing a group of young white kids walking down the street, the thought of jumping out, searching them, wouldn't even cross his mind. Now, that officer may not be meaning any harm to those young black kids, but those biases and stereotypes play themselves out thousands, hundreds of thousands of times, adding up to enormous disparities in our criminal justice system. For example, take New York City. The New York Police Department stopped and frisked 650,000 people in 1 year. 650,000 people in 1 year, close to 90% of whom were African American or Latino. In fact, the numbers of African American men who were stopped and frisked, of young African American men who were stopped and frisked, actually exceeds the total black men in New York City, meaning that many folks were stopped and frisked over and over and over again. These disparities add up to enormous disparities in our criminal justice system, but the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that we can't even challenge these disparities in a court of law. In this way, the U.S. Supreme Court has effectively immunized this system of mass incarceration from judicial scrutiny for racial bias, much in the same way that the U.S. Supreme Court rallied to the defense of slavery and rallied to the defense of Jim Crow in their day. But of course, being swept into this system with really no hope of challenging it is just the beginning of the odyssey for so many, because once you're swept in and branded a criminal or felon, you're ushered into a parallel social universe, a permanent second-class status, for the rest of your life. Numerous forms of discrimination are perfectly legal. Employment discrimination. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box on employment applications asking the dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And it doesn't matter if that felony happened a few weeks ago, 4 months ago, 4 years ago, or 45 years ago. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box, knowing full well either sky high that application is going straight to the trash. Hundreds of professional licenses are off limits to people with felony records. In my state, in Ohio, you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been convicted of a felony. People say to me, oh, come on, you're making excuses for people. You know, if you really want a job and you get out of prison, if you really want one, you can get one. You know, stop making excuses for people. They could get a job at McDonald's or something if they really wanted to work. Getting a job at McDonald's is no easy feat if you have a felony record. Employment discrimination? Where are you going to work? How are you going to just make money, feed yourself? And then there's housing discrimination. Public housing projects as well as private landlords free to discriminate against you. Where are you going to sleep? Public benefits may be off limits to you, as I mentioned. Food stamps under federal law are deemed off limits to you for the rest of your life if you've been once convicted of a drug felony. Fortunately, many states have opted out of the ban on food stamps for people with drug felonies, but it remains the case that thousands of people can't even get food stamps because they were once caught with drugs. What are people released from prison supposed to do? You're released from prison, fresh out of jail, can't get a job, can't get housing, food stamps may even be off limits to you. what we expect them to do is to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support, which continues to accrue while you're in prison. And then in a growing number of states, you're actually expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. And paying back all these fees, fines, and court costs are often considered a condition of your probation and parole, never mind that you can't even get a job. And then get this, if you're one of the lucky few who actually manages to get a job, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished, 100%, to pay back all those fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. What do we expect folks to do? When we step back and take a look at how the system operates as a whole, I think it's fair to ask, what does it seem designed to do? Seems designed, in my view, to send folks right back to prison, which is what, in fact, happens about 70% of the time. About 70% of people released from prison return within 3 years, and the majority of those who return in some states do so in a matter of months because the challenges associated with just mere survival on the outside are so immense. So what do we do? Well, one thing is clear in retrospect to me is that those of us in the civil rights community, we've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. While many of us have been fighting to preserve affirmative action, struggling to cling to the gains, the perceived gains of the past, millions of people have been rounded up, locked in cages, and stripped of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. More than $1 trillion has been spent since the drug war began. $1 trillion waging the drug war alone. Funds that could have been used for education, for job creation, funds that could have been used for collective well-being. Instead, $1 trillion has been invested in destroying countless lives, families, and dreams. We're constantly being told there's not enough money to pay teachers. There's not enough money for good schools. And yet we had $1 trillion to spend, to blow, and we used it building prisons and jails. So what do we do? Well, my own view is that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. And if you imagine that surely something less would do, surely something less would do than a major social movement, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s or the early 1980s before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement really kicked off, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. 4 out of 5. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities. Communities are often quite vulnerable economically. Many of these communities have been sold on prisons as an answer to their economic woes, and quite frequently, prisons don't provide all the benefits that are advertised, but nonetheless, these communities have come to believe that their economies depend on prisons, and those prisons across America would have to close down. Private prison companies now listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits just vanish. Poof. This system is now so deeply rooted in our social, political, and economic structure that it's not going to just fade away. Not going to just downsize out of sight without a major upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. Now, I know that there's many people today who will say there's just no hope of ending mass incarceration, just as many people were resigned to Jim Crow in the South and would say, oh, yeah, that's a shame, but that's just the way that it is. Today, I find many people view the millions cycling in and out of our prisons and jails as just an unfortunate but inalterable fact of American life. Well, I am quite certain that Dr. King and Ella Baker and Rosa Parks, Ann Braden, the many, many people who risked their lives to end the old Jim Crow would not be so easily deterred. So I believe we have got to be willing to pick up where they left off and do the hard work of movement building on behalf of poor people of all colors. In 1968, yeah. In 1968, Dr. King told advocates that the time had come to shift from a civil rights movement to a human rights movement. Meaningful equality, said, could not be achieved through civil rights alone. Without basic human rights, the right to work, the right to housing, the right to quality education, without basic human rights, civil rights are an empty promise. So in honor of Dr. King and all those who labored to end earlier systems of control, I hope that we will build a human rights movement to end mass incarceration, a movement for education, not incarceration, a movement for jobs, not jails, a movement that will end all forms of discrimination against people released from prison, discrimination that denies them basic human rights to work, to shelter, and to food. Now, what must we do to build this movement? Well, first, I think we have got to be willing to tell the truth, the whole truth. We've got to be willing to admit out loud that we as a nation have managed to recreate a caste-like system in this country. We've got to be willing to tell this truth in our schools, in our churches, in our places of worship. We've got to be willing to tell it in reentry centers and behind bars. We've got to be willing to tell this truth so that a great awakening can begin. You know, back during the old Jim Crow, there was no denying the existence of a caste system. There were whites-only signs.
For that very warm welcome. It is such an honor to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this outstanding lecture series, and I am thrilled to see so many of you here, people who are willing to engage in meaningful dialogue about this system of mass incarceration, a system that has decimated so many of our communities, destroyed so many families, and turned back the clock on racial progress in the United States. We stand now at a critical moment in our nation's history. We do have a presidential election going on, and notably, mass incarceration has not been a topic of discussion or debate. And not one of the debates was a question asked or an answer given, not only about poverty in the United States, but the millions who are locked into a permanent second-class status for life, the millions who are now trapped in a permanent undercaste, the millions who are part of the other America. But in my view, the presidential election isn't the most important thing going on, at least not with respect to the work that has become the passion of my life. I believe we're at a critical moment in our history because for the first time in a long, long time, there are rumblings in the streets. There are rumblings and voices being raised and people who have been locked up and locked out beginning to find their voice, beginning to organize, beginning to think seriously about building a movement to end this system. And these rumblings are coming at a particularly important time. For the first time in more than 40 years, politicians across the political spectrum are beginning to raise questions about this race to incarcerate. They're beginning to wonder out loud whether we can afford the massive prison state that has been constructed in recent years. Now, their concerns are not driven primarily, or perhaps at all, by the lies of people who have been trapped within the system, the families that have been destroyed. No, this sudden concern across the political spectrum is driven mainly by concerns about costs, how much it costs to lock people up in a time of economic crisis. And because politicians are reluctant to raise taxes on the predominantly white middle class, suddenly we hear conversation about maybe it's time for a little prison downsizing. And so two things are happening at the same time. You see that people are beginning to wake up, find their voice, and speak out at precisely the same time that a window is opening, a window of opportunity. I think the question that is posed by this moment in our nation's history is whether what will come of this time is just a little bit of prison downsizing so that this massive prison state suddenly becomes a little bit more affordable, will downsize somewhat and reach a new plateau of indifference. We'll pat ourselves on the back and say, well, a job well done. We shrunk the prison system a little bit and go on about our daily lives, reform activists moving on to something else, even as millions remain trapped, cycling in and out of prisons and jails, or whether we might be standing now at the beginning of a new movement for social and racial justice, a movement that will not end until we defeat the system of mass incarceration and break the cycle of caste in America. We stand now, I believe, at a fork in the road. And I hope we will not sleep through this moment in our history. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. once said, there is, quote, nothing more tragic than to sleep through a revolution, end quote. And he was talking at that time about a profound moral revolution that was underway, the struggle for the recognition of the dignity and humanity of all kind, a struggle to end what was then America's latest caste system known as Jim Crow. And in the months before his death, he was speaking to a large audience, and he told the story of Rip Van Winkle, who famously fell asleep for 20 years. And he pointed out to the audience that when Rip began his extended nap, there was a sign emblazoned on the wall of a nearby inn that had a picture of King George III on it. But when Rip woke up 2 decades later, that same sign had a picture of George Washington on it. And Dr. King said, what is most remarkable about the story of Rip Van Winkle isn't that he slept for 20 years, but that he had slept through a revolution. He said, quote, there are all too many people who, in some great period of social change, failed to achieve the new mental outlooks that the new situation demands. Well, I think his words are as relevant today as they were back then. Many of us, myself included, have slept through a revolution, actually a counter-revolution. A counter-revolution that has blown back so much of the progress that Dr. King and Ella Baker and countless other activists fought for and some died for. This revolution has occurred with barely a whimper of protest, even as millions, millions of people have been rounded up, locked up, and then stripped of the very rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. While many of us have been asleep, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged, one that would certainly have Dr. King and many others turning in their graves. I believe one day we may look back and wonder how we could have possibly have slept for so long. Well, I've been asked to share with you today the thesis of my book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, and to a large extent, the title of the book speaks for itself. I believe that today, in the so-called era of colorblindness, and yes, even in the age of Obama, something akin to a caste system is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of poor people of color is tantamount to a new caste system, one specifically designed to address the social, political, and economic challenges of our time. It's the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, I am always eager to point out that I didn't always think this way, that I was asleep for a long, long time. Even as a civil rights lawyer and activist who spent most of my waking hours trying to work for racial justice, I didn't quite get it. I believed many of the myths that are sold to us today about the reason that our prison pop-